Welcome to the PRI Review, brought to you by the Population Research Institute. I'm your host, Christopher Mannion. Nearly 125 Indian members of Parliament backed petition to introduce a two-child policy. India should not repeat China's mistakes, Stephen Mosier says. The 125 lawmakers have signed a petition to Indian President Ram Nath Kovind calling for a nationwide two-child policy. MPs who signed the petition have called for a law prohibiting Indian couples from having more than two children, with stiff penalties for couples who exceed the proposed two-child limit. On August 9th, four MPs from the central Indian state of Madhya Pradesh met with President Kovind to personally deliver the petition letter and to make known their concerns about population growth. Also attending the meeting with President Kovind was Anil Chaudhary, representing a radical population control advocacy organization in India that has lobbied for a nationwide maximum two-child policy for all law for 3 years. We have submitted a document signed by almost 125 MPs to the president, and we have demanded a law on this so that we can control the increasing population, said MP Ganesh Singh, one of the four MPs who delivered the letter to President Kovind. Following the submission of the petition letter, Chaudhary called on lawmakers to introduce stiff penalties to enforce the proposed two-child policy. Once the proposal was adopted, whoever flouts that law, whoever proceeds to have a third child, they should not get any government benefits, and their voting rights should be withheld, Chaudhary said. He added that any couple that has a fourth child should be jailed. All four lawmakers that met with President Kovind were members of the Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Hindu Nationalist Party, the Bharatiya Janata, BJP. All MPs signing the petition were members of parties that are part of the National Democratic Alliance, NDA, the ruling right-wing political coalition in the Modi government. In India, the president does not exercise much power. However, the president does serve as the ceremonial head of state and as a check on the balance of power. The MPs meeting with the president is certain to lend high-profile credibility and publicity to the lawmakers' push for a two-child policy. While fears of a falling birth rate have caused the Chinese government to allow two children per family, fears of overpopulation are pushing India in the opposite direction. India should not repeat China's mistakes, says Population Research Institute President Stephen Mosier. People are the ultimate resource, the one resource you cannot do without. China has finally found that out after having eliminated 400 million from their own now aging and dying population. Last month, BJP lawmakers in both houses of parliament made demands for a nationwide population control law, claiming that population growth threatens to outpace gains made in areas of development. The requests were made during the zero hour, a period of the legislative session, where lawmakers can, with the permission of the speaker, raise issues of urgent public importance. Uday Pratap Singh, a BJP MP in India's lower house, specifically called on the government to introduce a two-child policy, citing China's one-child policy as an example of policies that other countries have implemented to control population growth. Last September, the Assam state government, led by the BJP, adopted a two-child policy which prohibits anyone with more than two children from holding a government job or from running for election for local government office. While several states had initiated two-child policies for government employees during the 1990s and the early 2000s, Assam is the first state in 10 years to adopt such a policy. Many states, including Himachal Pradesh, Madhya Pradesh, Haryana, and Chhattisgarh, have since repealed their two-child policies. Early this year, the Supreme Court of India received at least three separate public interest litigation pleas. One of the petitions was filed by Delhi BJP leader Ashwini Upadhyay. He based his case on the 2002 report of the National Commission to Review the Working of the Constitution. The commission had recommended that an amendment be added to the Constitution of India to, and I quote, secure control of the population by means of education and implementation of small family norms, end quote. In 2000, the commission had been authorized by the NDA-controlled parliament to offer recommendations to lawmakers for new constitutional amendments. The government's refusal to adopt the commission's recommendation for a population control amendment has long been a point of frustration for some NDA partisans. Another case filed by Anuj Saxena and others petitioned the Supreme Court to direct the Indian government to adopt strict population control measures. The petition called for rewarding families adhering to the two-child policy and to punish those who don't. Saxena claimed that India's unprecedented and lethal population explosion, as he calls it, threatens the environment and contributes to unemployment, poverty, and overcrowding. The Supreme Court has refused to hear both the Saxena and Upadhyay cases for procedural reasons. In the Saxena case, the court dismissed the plea, stipulating that the issue was a policy matter, that is, for Parliament to decide, not the court. Population control policies in India have long served as a flashpoint between Hindu nationalist advocates and Muslims and the poor who have viewed such policies with suspicion. Population control initiatives are widely viewed in India as an indirect attempt to lower the population of Indian Muslims and of poor and rural Indians. Both groups tend to have larger families. Meanwhile, most Hindu families already average 2 children or less. According to the National Family Health Survey, the total fertility rate among Indian Muslims for 2015-16 was 2.62 children per woman of reproductive age, while the rate among Hindus was 2.13. This represents a significant drop from the fertility rates observed for both demographic groups only 10 years ago, when the rate was 3.40 among Indian Muslims and 2.59 among Hindus. With the fertility rate of Indian Hindus at or close to replacement fertility, some Hindu nationalist politicians have clamored for Hindu couples to boost their fertility in order to increase the number of Hindu followers compared to other religious groups in the country. In 2015, Sakshi Maharaj, a BJP MP, particularly well known for making controversial remarks, urged that every Hindu woman must produce at least 4 children to protect the Hindu religion, end quote. Population control policies in India are often rooted in anti-Muslim animosity, often displayed by certain Hindu nationalist partisans. Earlier this year, Union Minister of State and BJP MP Giriraj Singh commented that the growing population of the country, especially Muslims, is a threat to the social fabric, social harmony, and development of the country, end quote. Recently, BJP MP Vijay Pal Singh Tomar said on the floor of Parliament that population growth in India needed to be curbed part and parcel because children were being born in the name of Allah and Bhagwan, the latter term referring to a controversial anti-Hindu mystic preacher. Population control policies have a long history in India. In the late 1950s, India became the first country in the modern era to implement policies directly targeted at reducing the country's population growth rate. In the late 1970s, approximately 8 million Indian citizens, mostly men, were forcibly sterilized in a single year by the government under Prime Minister Indira Gandhi during the so-called emergency, a period in India's history when the government suspended civil liberties and imprisoned political rivals under a declaration of a state emergency. In India, population control policies have long enjoyed public support from a significant subset of the citizenry. While Malthusian ideology no longer prevails in most of the world, it continues to enjoy wide acceptance in India. So the belief that the country is overpopulated and in need of population control is not uncommon. Despite Malthusian alarmism espoused by certain BJP politicians and voters, however, the rate of population growth in India has slowed considerably in recent decades. The UN projects that India's population will peak at 1.68 billion in 2060 and will then begin to contract. In fact, the fertility rate in India has been plummeting for more than half a century. India's total fertility rate in the early 1960s stood at 5.89 births per 1,000 women of reproductive age. Projections indicate that the rate will fall to 2.28 this year. Similarly, official government statistics estimated an All India rate of only 2.3 in 2013. In urban areas and in several states, India's fertility rate has fallen below the replacement level. According to official government statistics, the total fertility rate in urban areas fell to 1.8 children per woman of reproductive age in 2013. The fertility rate for India overall sits only slightly higher than the replacement rate. Official estimates indicate that the fertility rate necessary to meet the replacement level in India will be 2.26 for the years 2015 to 2020. Since 1950, India's population has more than tripled. It is projected to reach 1.35 billion in 2018. Yet over that same time period, the birth rate has fallen by an estimated 58%. India's total fertility rate has markedly declined as well. India's population growth does not appear to have had a negative effect on the country's development. From 1991 to 2015, India added some 240 million people to its population, roughly the equivalent of the 2015 populations of the United States, Canada, and the United Kingdom combined. Despite this increase, the percentage of population living with hunger in India has declined significantly. According to data from the Food and Agricultural Organization, the prevalence of undernourishment in India fell by nearly 40% between 1991 and 2015. Food in India has also become more affordable. According to the UN's Food Price Index, India's index fell by nearly 5% between 2000 and 2014. Access to safe drinking water has also improved in India. According to World Health Organization data, the percentage of the population with access to safely managed drinking water has increased by 69% since the year 2000 in rural areas of the country. Moreover, India's population does not appear to have hampered economic growth, and according to the World Bank, per capita income has more than tripled since 1990. When we come back, Chinese provincial government calls for an end to birth restrictions. Do you want to win pro-life legislative and political battles? For years, PRI has been helping pro-life leaders on the ground around the world to win legislative and political battles in order to protect the lives of the unborn. And now we're asking for your help so we can continue this vital work. Let me tell you more. In a number of countries around the world, there are still pro-life laws on the books. But the Planned Parenthood abortion liberales Malthusians are out there to get rid of those laws. Nearly 5 years ago, the Pontifical Council on the Family asked PRI to be the main organization to help the pro-life movements around the world to be more effective. In response to the Vatican's request, we created our Pro-Life Victory Seminars and our Pro-Life Strategy Guide. The seminars are grueling, demanding 12 to 14-hour intense working sessions. Only the most proven and successful leaders are invited to speak. Only the best and the most committed activists are invited to attend. To date, we have conducted 60 such sessions in 18 countries. We have trained more than 1,700 people who are serious about protecting the unborn in their respective countries. They have won some victories, but I'm not going to tell you about those because I don't want to put a target on the back of those leaders. I'm not going to tell you the names of their countries either because I don't want to make it even harder for them to do their work. But here's a hint. Most, though not all, have Spanish as their native tongue. It's no secret that south of our border, pro-abortionists are zeroing in on the existing pro-life laws in that part of the world. I cannot tell you the battle stories, although there are many, without endangering the victories of the leaders. I must ask you to take my word that some battles in some countries could not have been won without the training and support received from PRI. What kind of training am I talking about? Everywhere in the world, defenders of life need everything: strategic thinking skills, campaign skills, legislative skills, lobbying skills, to protect their pro-life laws and to stop pro-death initiatives. Around the world, we found that the biggest thing lacking is know-how. By that, I mean political sophistication. Here in America, we've been fighting pro-life battles for almost 50 years, and while we haven't won definitively, we have learned a lot about how to fight, as well as how not to fight. One of the most important tools of our pro-life victory training is the manual that the trainees get to take home with them, the Pro-Life Strategy Guide, the guide to winning pro-life battles. Think of it as a field guide to activism. The guide is a compendium of know-how. It is 200 pages of distilled experience and wisdom, with step-by-step instructions about how to advance our issue in a representative landscape. Here's a small sampling of the know-how delivered in these training sessions. How to raise money, how to lobby legislators, how to write powerful pro-life advertising, how to effectively appear on TV and radio, how to enlist volunteers, how to get out the vote, and how to successfully debate pro-abortionists. All this and much, much more is covered in the training program and reinforced in the training guide. The first edition came out in 2012, but we are all out of them now. They have all been put in the hands of able pro-life leaders. So today we have had it revised and updated by two of the best and most successful activists in the Spanish-speaking world. Today, the new PRI, Pro-Life Strategy Guide, the guide to winning pro-life battles, is ready to go to press. This is where you come in. Will you help us get it into the hands of the people who need it? It's in Spanish right now, and that's as it should be, because we distribute it throughout the Spanish-speaking world. The Vatican wants this field manual in every diocese in the world. Will you help me to fulfill that request? PRI has ordered 10,000 copies of the guide to be printed, enough for every student who will attend our training sessions for the next several years, along with all the actively pro-life bishops around the world. Just the printing alone will cost $50,000. The whole International Victory Training Program costs another $50,000, and that is in addition to the field guide. But right now, we want to get those guides printed. So I turn to you because I know you understand its value. The cost comes out to about $5 per book, which is not very much considering the impact it can have and the lives it can save. With your tax-deductible gift of $50, PRI can put this guide into the hands of 10 in-country pro-life leaders. With a gift of $100, we can make sure that 10 friendly bishops get a copy to guide their strategic thinking in the protection of life. No gift is too small. If you can only spare $5, please send it today. Unborn babies around the world will be safer because of your sacrifice today. Can we count on you to help PRI to continue to train and empower the pro-life movement around the world? On behalf of all those fighting to preserve pro-life laws around the world, thank you.
Chinese provincial government calls for an end to birth restrictions. The PRC's planned birth policy continues its shift towards more births. The provincial government in Shanxi, a province in north-central China, has published a report that calls for an abolition of birth limits under China's planned birth policy. Currently, China's two-child policy prohibits couples from having more than two children. In many provinces, couples are allowed a third child only in narrowly crafted special circumstances that often require government approval, such as when a child has a severe disability or in second marriages. Couples who exceed their government-mandated birth quota can be subjected to steep fines significantly larger than their annual household income. On June 29th, the Shaanxi Provisional Bureau of Statistics released a report entitled Development Report of Population Development in Shaanxi Province in 2017, which calls for family planning policies to be abolished when the time is right, end quote. The report also encourages that policies be introduced to increase the birth rate, including offering subsidies to women who have another child, policies to protect women's employment security, increasing the availability of maternal and child health services, and improving health systems and early childhood education infrastructure. The Shaanxi report has further added to growing speculation over the past several months that the Chinese central government may soon be preparing to scrap its nearly four decades-old planned birth policy, perhaps as early as later this year. According to Population Research Institute President Stephen Mosier, the move by the Shaanxi provincial government may indicate that policy changes from the central government to increase the birth rate could be forthcoming. Ambitious provincial leaders often try and anticipate changes in national policy by getting one step ahead of Beijing, Mosier says. It's a dangerous game, but it can lead to national recognition as a model province and promotion for the provincial Communist Party secretary. This report, along with other signs, shows that the Chinese state is moving decisively in the direction of urging higher birth rates, he says. A Bloomberg article earlier this year reported that sources had revealed that China's State Council, the cabinet of the Chinese government, had commissioned a study on the social impact of removing all birth limits. According to Bloomberg, the study was commissioned at the behest of China Premier Li Keqiang, the second highest-ranking official in the Chinese Communist Party. The study was commissioned by Li after receiving the results from a prior study in April which found limited benefits to abolishing birth limits. Moreover, the sources had conveyed that the State Council was making preparations to change the country's planned birth policy. Among the policy proposals being discussed by officials, according to the Bloomberg piece, is an independent fertility policy which would abolish all birth limits and allow couples to freely choose the number of children they want to have. For nearly four decades, the Chinese government has imposed stringent birth limits, restricting couples to no more than one or two children, in a radical attempt to drastically reduce the country's birth rate. Under China's one-child and two-child policies, millions of women were punished with crushing fines and forced to submit to abortion, sterilization, or IUD insertion if they were found to have exceeded their government-allocated birth quota. The Chinese government claims that its one-child policy prevented over 400 million births. But now, after more than 20 years of below-replacement fertility, Chinese society is beginning to feel the demographic consequences of the government's planned birth policies. Since 1990, the fertility rate in China has been below the replacement rate, the rate necessary to prevent population decline. As a result, China's population structure has transitioned. According to data from the National Bureau of Statistics annual 1% survey, the working age population in China has decreased consistently every year since 2011. At the same time, the country faces the prospect of rapid population aging in the coming years. The Chinese government projects 25% of the population of the country will be 60 or older by 2030. That's up from only 13% in 2010. Chinese officials, concerned that current demographic trends threaten to undercut economic growth and the credibility of the Communist Party, are now increasingly looking for ways to boost the birth rate. In an effort to mitigate the burden of population aging, the Chinese government in 2016 abandoned its one-child policy, opting instead for a two-child policy which now allows all legally married couples to have a second child, but no more. However, the two-child policy has not produced the baby boom that the Communist Party leaders had hoped for. While the number of births in 2016 increased by 8% over 2015, the number of births in China sagged the following year with 630,000 fewer births last year than in 2016. Some Chinese officials and demographers are now calling for the government to remove all birth limits, a sharp turnaround from only a few years ago, when only officials in the central government were allowed to discuss the national planned birth policy. In March, a deputy in the National People's Congress, NPC, the Chinese government's rubber-stamp Congress, put forth a proposal for the government to transition from a two-child policy to a three-child policy. Zhu Liu, the NPC deputy proposing the measure, was quoted at the time by Sina Finance, saying, "If we do not adjust the population policy as soon as possible and increase the population, China will become a country with low fertility levels. Therefore, it is recommended that the two-child policy be fully liberalized and changed to a three-child policy as soon as possible," end quote. Liu went on to say that if the country's birth decline did not reverse under a three-child policy, the government should consider ending family planning policies altogether. In June, an article that appeared on the website thepaper.cn reported that the vice dean of the Institute of International Strategic Studies at the Central Party School of the Communist Party, Zhu Tianyong, had authored an article that was published in a magazine issued by the Ministry of Human Resources and Social Security. It called for the government to abolish altogether the planned birth policy and remove all birth limits on Chinese couples. The Central Party School is the Chinese government's institution of higher education for training officials for civil service and for leadership positions in the Communist Party. And I quote, "We should urgently and completely allow women to freely have children and cancel the one-child birthing system," comma, close quote. The paper quoted Zhu from his article. Family planning personnel should receive settlement from the government. The social support fees should be abolished, and past due social support payments should not be collected, he said. Even a former official who once headed a division of the National Family Planning Commission, the state council agency once responsible for implementing the one-child policy, has come out publicly in favor of removing the birth limits, telling Bloomberg in an interview that the removal of birth limits is already past due, but it's better than never. Over the past year, the Chinese government has taken steps to distance itself from the family planning policies of the past. In March, the National Health and Family Planning Commission, the executive agency long responsible for implementing the one-child policy, was reorganized as the National Health Commission. The move represents the first time since 1956 that no executive agency in the state council bears the phrase family planning or birth planning in its name. And for the first time in nearly 30 years, the party work report from the 2017 National Congress of the Communist Party failed to mention the term birth control. In his address to the National Congress last year, Chinese President Xi Jinping also did not make the customary reference to family planning. Reports have also indicated that local government officials in some parts of China may have eased off enforcing the two-child policy. According to an article from ET Today, cadres in Shenzhou, Zhangji province no longer assessed fines for over-quota births. One Henan agricultural worker whose wife recently gave birth to a third child without sanction told ET Today, "In a few villages around us, there are many cases in which a family has three or four children. I have hardly ever heard of a fine." End quote. In the far northern province of Heilongjiang, where fertility rates are low, the provincial-level government in 2016 even changed its family planning regulations to allow couples living in the province's border districts to have a third child, representing the first time since the one-child policy was introduced that all ethnic Han Chinese in a given territory are legally permitted to have a third child. Still, couples who exceed their two-child quota in many provinces are still technically subject to strict fines and penalties, and reports have indicated that the policy continues to be enforced to this day in much of the country. Population Research Institute investigators found evidence last year that the two-child policy was still being rigorously enforced in some parts of China. An investigation by John Sudworth of the BBC in 2016 found that couples under the two-child policy continued to be subjected to coercive home visits and threats of mandatory abortion if discovered with an out-of-quota child. Other family planning restrictions remain enforced in parts of China. In Yunnan province, for instance, villages are still required to meet annual government-mandated sterilization quotas, and local officials maintain lists of eligible candidates for sterilization. Steep fines for past violations of the one-child policy also continue to be levied on couples under the two-child policy. According to ET Today, 221 people in Luoyang, Hunan province, were recently placed on a list of unworthy enforcers after failing to pay the social support fees for over-quota births. And in several provinces, couples who exceeded their birth quota can still be punished with loss of employment, mandatory abortion, wage garnishment, and fines. This is PRI Review from pop.org. We'll be right back. What's the best way to celebrate Humani Vitae's 50th birthday? For most of us, the answer is close to home, and specifically in our own parishes. Here's why. 6 years ago, when Timothy Cardinal Dolan was president of the U.S. Bishops' Conference, he admitted that our bishops have had laryngitis on Blessed Pope Paul's beautiful encyclical. Laryngitis for 50 years! Unfortunately, that's still true for many bishops who are too tied up with the political agenda of their national bureaucracy in Washington. There, issues like global warming, socialized medicine, and federal contracts for the bishops' welfare agencies have dominated the agenda for years, crowding out pro-life efforts and leaving Humanae Vitae an orphan. That doesn't mean that the lay faithful haven't been asking. We have. In fact, pleas to our shepherds have had some heartwarming results in recent months, with several bishops coming forward with strong public defenses of Humanae Vitae. But the real work has to come from the grassroots, and that means the laity, because our busy bishops can't do it alone. They need our support, our encouragement, and our prayers. After all, the pro-life movement started at the grassroots, and its strength has stayed there. Bishops are often supportive of pro-life groups in their dioceses, but few are focused on them. Most chancery staffs spend much more time on immigration, refugees, fundraising, and other programs that receive federal funding. Pro-life efforts receive no federal funding, so pro-lifers have to fend for ourselves. While our bishops have countless distractions, our parish priests know us and we know them. They offer our most reliable source of support and encouragement when it comes to celebrating Humanae Vitae's birthday party. And a wise pastor has a good suggestion on how to make it work. It boils down to this. Instead of telling your pastor, "Father, you ought to do something about this," tell him, "Father, a group of us would like to have a reading group in the parish to study Humanae Vitae. We've got the texts, the commentaries, and all the materials. All we need is some space in the parish one night a week and an announcement in the bulletin to spread the word. Don't worry, we'll do all the work, but we'd love to have your support, and it would be great if you could join us whenever you can." And by the way, a further note from long pastoral experience, don't ask Father on the way out of Mass. Write him a note and ask him for a few minutes of his time at his convenience. There you'll have his full attention, and he can write down what he remembers of your conversation, and that's impossible when 50 or 100 people are shaking his hand after every service. Writing that letter also gives you the opportunity to pad your pitch with some supporting evidence. In this case, not only the support from bishops, including your own, we hope, but especially referring to the world-class conference that the bishops sponsored in Washington at the Catholic University of America last April. It was thanks
to the support from Catholic University's stalwart president John Garvey that this conference came off without a hitch, with the admirable support of the conference offered 3 days of top-notch speakers and presentations, and they're all online. Supporters of Humani Vitae can cite this national conference as their inspiration for activities throughout the country in the diocesan and parish levels. And here's some great news. Our new website devoted to Humani Vitae is now online. It's a treasure trove of information for your parish group. Here's how to find it. Go to your website browser and type in humanevitae.org, no spaces, and remember, the dot is a period. There you will find a treasure trove of information for your parish group. Just go to humanevitae.org to find not only the masterful history of contraception by Dr. Gonzalo Herranz in four languages, and by the way, that's the history of the promotion of contraception against church teaching and natural law for over 100 years. But it also includes the latest news and links in a wide array of resources. We'll be updating the site continually with new reports, materials, and insights from all over the world. In no time, it will be your go-to site for Humanae Vitae news. Remember, just go to humanevitaeproject.org and enjoy. And please don't forget to support PRI so that we can keep this project worldwide in four languages going until everyone knows the truth about Humani Vitae.
Victory in Argentina. How we defeated the international abortion lobby and protected the right to life. On August 9, 2018, pro-lifers in Argentina won a great victory, not just for Argentinians, but for the entire world. That country's Senate voted down a bill to legalize abortion. It was a close-run thing. The bill had already passed the Argentinian lower house, called the Chamber of Deputies, and seemed unstoppable. Just 2 months before, it did not even seem possible to stop the bill in the Senate. But over the past few weeks, pro-lifers organized, demonstrated, and began to put real pressure on their elected representatives. The result was a victory for the right to life for the unborn child. The Chamber of Deputies approved the pro-abortion bill on June 23rd after a long day of fractious debate. Three lawmakers who had earlier said they would vote against abortion strangely changed their minds at the last minute. They instead voted to legalize the death of unborn children. Many in Argentina were outraged by this betrayal of the country's long-standing pro-life principles. Argentine politicians were quickly to learn just how dangerous it can be to their political careers when they bring down upon themselves the wrath of the voters. In order to become law, both chambers of the Argentinian parliament must approve it. So the battle for life, though lost in the House, could still be won in the Chamber of Senators. The Argentinian parliament, with its upper and lower houses, is modeled upon the American Congress. Much like the U.S. House of Representatives, the number of lawmakers representing each province in the Argentinian Chamber of Deputies are elected according to the number of people living in each territory. For example, the province of Buenos Aires has 35 representatives, while Tucumán, one of the smallest in the country, has only 9. In contrast, much like the U.S. Senate, each Argentinian province has the same number of senators. Thus, Buenos Aires and Tucumán have 3 senators each. With the battle moving to the Chamber of Senators, pro-lifers were faced with a challenge to convince a majority of the 72 senators to reject the bill. At the outset, this appeared to be nearly impossible. But then something never before seen in Argentina began to develop, a mass movement in favor of life. A lawyer, Martin Ceballos, coined a phrase in an article he wrote for the newspaper Clarín. Argentina had a sleeping giant that has awoken, Ceballos wrote, and he has a sky-blue neckerchief. Ceballos was referring to the sky-blue neckerchiefs that had become the symbol of those who defend the right to life, This is a symbol which recalls the sky-blue Argentinian flag, and so the love of the unborn became synonymous with love of country. On the other hand, pro-abortion activists wore green neckerchiefs. This color, the color of a dollar bill, quickly became identified with the international financial pressure on Argentina to legalize abortion. This color blindness turned out to be a major strategic blunder on the part of the pro-aborts. Pro-lifers also won the messaging campaign, adopting a great slogan, "Let us save two lives." This referred to saving both the child's life and the mother's, and helped to rally support to the pro-life cause. Pro-lifers also suddenly woke up to the fact that they needed to become politically active. They realized that their senators were very attentive to pressure from voters and were acutely aware of the number of votes they need to get reelected. Originally, many pro-lifers thought that convincing lawmakers that abortion is a moral evil or medically unnecessary was the path to victory. That is, they thought that they needed to argue that life begins at conception and that laws must protect the right to life as a matter of science and morality. More than 400 lawyers, doctors, biologists, and even journalists testified before Congress in defense of the right to life in the various committees where the abortion bill were being considered. The lawmakers were unmoved. It soon became evident to pro-lifers that their legislators were not basing their vote on moral or scientific considerations, but solely on political considerations. The sleeping giant had awoken. Pro-lifers began to visit their senators and say, bluntly, "If you vote for abortion, I will not vote for you in the next election." This strategy paid immediate dividends, especially since the next elections are in 2019. Those lawmakers who wanted to be reelected again as senators began to pay attention to the concerns of pro-lifers, and pro-lifers, for their part, began to realize that political activism, previously non-existent among pro-lifers, can make a real difference. One by one, senators began expressing their concern that the abortion bill was poorly drafted and stating that they would be voting against it. The wave of political momentum to keep abortion illegal in Argentina started growing. By the time of the vote, even the country's most important newspapers, Clarín y La Nación, recognized that the abortion bill would be defeated. The miracle was the result of a lot of pro-life work, a lot of mobilization from normal everyday people. But more than anything else, it was the result of citizens realizing the power that they have to act in a democratic society. Argentinian pro-lifers realized that this power needs to be exercised not through timid pleas, but by demanding that rights be respected. In the weeks leading up to the vote, the streets were no longer a place for left-wing activists, but rather pro-lifers occupied the space to civilly demand that there can be no law to legalize abortion in Argentina, and pro-lifers achieved their goal. After the profound defeat in the Irish abortion referendum, Argentina has now changed the axis of the abortion debate. Argentina has provided Latin America and the world with a good example of how people can stop the global anti-life tsunami. Pro-lifers can stop anti-life legislation even with only a small amount of funding, so long as they advance their cause with great passion and a clear focus. The pro-life Argentine sleeping giant will stay awake and active. There are many people now who are engaged in the important political battles going forward. Groups that were formed to lobby against the abortion bill are already studying how to change other anti-life laws. The next challenge for pro-lifers will be a bill that will revise the criminal code, which could be voted upon soon. But they will be talking to politicians who will listen this time around, and they will be telling them, "We will be paying attention to how you'll be voting on this bill, and we ourselves will only vote for politicians who will say not only promise to defend life, but actually fulfill their promises." The Argentinian political landscape has changed forever. Pro-life issues will no longer be a minor issue, and soon we will see more and more pro-life senators and deputies. Some will be pro-life as a matter of principle, others will be pro-life out of the political prudence. But both of these groups will vote the right way, because pro-lifers will be watching. This victory sends very clear messages to the rest of Latin America. Pro-life movements in other Latin American countries were following closely the situation in Argentina in solidarity with Argentine pro-lifers. And now they know what pro-life people are able to accomplish when they set their minds to it. The Population Research Institute has played an active role throughout this process of organizing and encouraging the Argentinian pro-life movement. PRI's offices in Latin America and Europe, and particularly PRI's newest division, RELEASE, has been read and studied by those involved in the pro-life battle in Argentina. Many groups and people in Argentina found our advice and analysis key to building the way for this successful campaign. PRI is now committed to advancing this winning model elsewhere, for this great victory in Argentina must breathe new life into all those who defend life and family. Pro-lifers should be encouraged to raise their voices. Do not be afraid of those who want to impose the culture of the politically correct. Fight back. The Argentine nation has won a great victory for life and for the family, and we at PRI are proud to have played a part. Thank you, Argentina.
This has been the PRI Review from the Population Research Institute at pop.org. Thanks for listening.